The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, May 18th, 2007, and this is show number 78. Thank you very much for downloading the show. I'm Bob Hayes, your host. We got a fairly short show today. We're just starting getting back on track of getting the shows in order and going back to a once-a-week schedule and all that sort of thing. But I got a good one. It's, like I said, it's a little bit short, but it's going to be long on content. How's that? First of all, we're going to have a listener email I'm going to talk about a little bit that I thought was real interesting. And then we got a call from Liam Schubert. We talked to Liam while he was in Spain. He'd just gotten back from the China Grand Prix. He'd stayed over in Shanghai for a few days extra. He was in Barcelona for a few days before he had to head out to Le Mans. So I managed to catch him on the day before he left for Le Mans. And he was nice enough to spend about half an hour or so on the phone with us. And we got some real good insight there from Liam again. Before we get to all that, I'd like to say a big thank you to Eric Sandin of Boulder, Colorado, for a very generous donation to the MotoGPOD cause. I do appreciate that. Thank you very much, Eric. And also thanks to all of the listeners out there that sent in emails and feedback on some of our recent shows that Jules and I have been doing, and Jim Race as well. Appreciate that. It's always good to hear from you guys. Ideas, criticism, whatever it is, anything, we always like to hear it because it's always helpful, or at least, you know, it's nice to hear from listeners and know that somebody out there is listening. So if you want to send in an email, you can send it to a variety of email addresses. You could send it to motogpod@motogpod.com, and that goes to all of us, myself, Jules Chisek, and Jim Race. Or we all have our own individual email addresses as well. If you'd like to send something, Badmouth and Jules or something, and you just want me to hear it, that's fine. Send that to Bob@MotoGPOD. Or if you'd like to send something to Jules, Badmouth, and me, that's fine too. And you can send that to PopMonkey@MotoGPOD.com. Or you can send stuff to Jim Race, Badmouth, and both the rest of us, and that goes to Race@MotoGPOD. And I kind of hope you don't badmouth us a lot. But, you know, hey, like I said, we do appreciate all email one way or the other, whether it's, you know, hey, I like your show, or hey, you guys need to fix this, or whatever. You know, obviously constructive criticism is much more appreciated than just outright vitriol, but we haven't had any vitriolic email anyway, so at least none that I can remember of, you know, you guys suck, something like that. So by and large, the email is very good, and I do thank you all out there for your feedback. Now, I do want to get another small issue out of the way. I am going to apologize in advance for the poor quality that we had going on with this call that I did with here with Liam, and somewhat for the last show number 77, where Jules and I were talking on Skype. I'm not 100% sure what's going on. I'm just having a terrible time getting the quality. We've got some ideas of what to try to fix that for future shows, but it just they've made some changes to Audio Hijack, the program that I use that records Skype. They've made some changes to Skype, and I just can't seem to get it right. So I've been doing some testing, and I'm going to be doing some more fiddling around and some other ideas, and we're going to see if we can't get that quality up there. So while I said, like Liam's call, it's a little twangy. I almost thought about ditching it altogether. I basically sound like I'm talking inside a trash can on it, but Liam is understandable, and he did take time out of his busy day, and he talked to us there for about half an hour, and he's always got interesting stuff to say, so I didn't want to just get rid of it. So I did my best to sort of clean it up. I think that it's acceptable. It's probably, you know, it's not as bad as you might hear occasionally, probably not as bad as you've heard on our show here before, but overall I wasn't too thrilled with the quality of it, but the audio quality, of course, the content quality of what Liam has to say is always super good. So we're going to go ahead and listen to that, and you know, let me know what you guys think. If you think that, okay, well, you know, if that's how Skype is going to be that day, and that's sort of the best quality that you can get, then go ahead and use it. Or if you think, you know, hey, I just can't stand it, you're going to have to do better, and just let me know. Appreciate it out there, because we do, when we're dealing with Skype or however we're recording these phone calls to Liam in Spain, and back and forth between myself and Jules, or between any of us, really, there's a lot of technical issues going on, and there's just such a wide variety of problems that we might run into that we seem to be running into them lately, and it's a little bit unfortunate because I thought I had this hammered out before I went on my deployment and seemed to be getting the quality pretty good, you know, by and large for what Skype is, but it just seems to be pretty much going to hell in a handbasket lately. So with all that administrative stuff out of the way, why don't we move on to our first little feature, and we're going to read an email from listener YT. All right, I want to share a couple of emails that I received from listener YT, who did not say where he's from, but I believe it's somewhere in the United States, judging from his email address and the way he talks and all that. And YT says, first of all, he's talking about some comments that Jules and I made in the last show, in show number 77, where we were saying that Hayden primarily won the championship in 2006 through being consistent, but not necessarily through being stellar or spectacular. He did a fantastically good job over and over and over and over again every week. And, you know, we weren't trying to shortchange Nicky Hayden for his achievement. He deserved the championship. He won it fair and square and all of that. We were just pointing out that it wasn't quite like where he's scored a lot of wins and just, you know, was a very, very spectacular. He did it through consistency. So YT has this to say, and he's primarily talking about the point scoring system, but the email's a little convoluted. I want you to listen here real quick. YT says, it ain't that he won only two races. Personally, I like the MotoGP scoring system. It takes five races, which is just over a quarter of a season, for the difference between first and second to make up for a DNF. That's a heck of a lot better than the Mickey Mouse club racing system used by the AMA, where it takes a dozen races, which rewards those who enter every race because the top 32 finishers score, while it penalizes anyone who cherry picks just a few. I even prefer it to the Formula One system, where it takes but five races to compensate for two DNFs. A champion ought to be consistent, also aggressive and confident. Nicky Hayden won the 2006 MotoGP Championship. He won it on the track without lawyers or special appeals, and he won it by coming from behind in the last race of the season. He also won it while leading fewer laps over the entire season than Troy Bayliss did. And to refresh your memory, Bayliss only started one race. A champion ought to be gracious. Nicky Hayden is gracious. And one of the wonderful things about a championship is that, over the course of the season, what could have happened did. For 2006, Hayden, riding on a Honda prepared by the Repsol team, whoever the heck they are, was just a smidge better than Valentino Rossi riding a Yamaha prepared by Jerry Burgess and his crew. Nicky Hayden was the best in the world last year. The scoreboard said so. Thought that was an excellent email. Jules actually replied to it first, and Jules basically said, agreed on all counts, but we weren't saying that Hayden didn't deserve it, just that in four races this year in 2007, Stoner has already had three wins, and the non-win was a fifth place, which is pretty unprecedented. Even Rossi hasn't had that sort of start to a season. The comparison to Nicky was to underline why, with only four races in, Stoner is already a major contender for the title. And I personally answered with something that was pretty similar to Jules' response, saying that I agreed with Jules, and then I agree with YT that the AMA point system isn't that great. And then we had a reply from YT saying, I know that you and Jules weren't saying that. I seized an opportunity to vent about what I've been hearing from others, and I may have buried my point, but my main complaint is with their reasoning. To say that Hayden won too few races is to complain about the scoring system, and I've said enough about that. A more persuasive complaint, in my opinion, is that he couldn't run at the front. So many times I've heard a race winner say something like, I let the other guy by so that I could see where he was fast, or excuse me, I let the other guy by so that I could see where he was faster and where he was slower. This is disingenuous. While there may be some of that going on, the main thing that sometime race leader is doing is relaxing, while the other guy shows him the braking points, turn-in points, and roll-on points for each of many consecutive corners. As tough-minded, as strong-willed a racer as Kenny Leroy Roberts felt that he could only do three laps at 100%, and by which I inferred not 100% of his best speed, but using 100% of his powers of concentration. It's so very hard to run at the front. Freddie Spencer led races from flag to flag and absolutely destroyed himself in 1985 when he had to do it twice every race day. Eddie Lawson couldn't do it. Wayne Rainey did. Mick Doohan did. Valentino Rossi did. And Casey Stoner is doing it now. Nicky Hayden may be carrying that big old number one on his back, but the only guys who can see it are the ones behind him. I've heard that it's tougher to retain a championship than it is to earn the first one. I can't say that I've seen a lot of evidence to support that claim, but it sure is impressive. So while YT's second email kind of diverges from his whole point about the MotoGP scoring system, and he's talking more about Nicky Hayden and being a champion, both emails I thought were pretty good and underscore a lot of points. But we primarily are talking here about the MotoGP scoring system, which gives you 25 points for a win, 20 points for second, 16 points for third, 13 points for fourth, 11 points for fifth, so on down the line. And to get back to that original point that YT was making about the MotoGP scoring system, he is right. But I'm going to add a little bit to his statement. MotoGP rewards consistently good performance, but you have to be consistently very good, not just consistently kind of sort of okay-ish good. And this is clearly shown by the fact that two second-place finishes will score more points than a first followed by a fourth. Those 2 seconds will give you 40 points, and a first and a fourth will only give you 38. And again, it kind of follows down the line because like 2 third-place finishes, so it's going to be better than a second and a fifth. So you can see that the weighting towards winning is apparent by the fact that if you get those 2 third-place finishes, you get 32 points, whereas a first and anything better than ninth is going to score more than those 32 points. So They want you to be consistent, but they want you to be consistently quite good. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think that's a good thing. It makes for an interesting championship. YT did lose me a little bit when the Formula One comparison where he says that, what did he say exactly? He said that it takes 5 races to compensate for 2 DNFs. I wasn't 100% sure on that because the Formula One scoring system gives you 10 points for first and 8 points for second and 6 points for third. And then it kind of goes down to 8th position with the final point scoring system. And basically in Formula One, they're not giving you enough points. It's a little confusing to me of why they have done it that way, because I think that it makes it too much so that a third place is almost as good as a first kind of a thing, that the points are too close together. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, you have something like AMA, where they award points for, you know, pole position, for fastest lap, and just lots of points for race wins and variety of things. And it just sort of, it gives too many points out. And the classic example of that is NASCAR, which I don't even understand their point scoring system and I don't even watch it, but I know that these guys get just ridiculously huge numbers of points. Whereas in a MotoGP season where you have 18 races, your highest possible number of points would be, 450 if you won every single race. And that's the most you can get. There are no points for pole. There's no points for most laps led or any of that kind of business. It's just, you know, you're rewarding points based on where the people are in the standings. And if you can consistently be on the podium, you're going to get a lot more points, which obviously sounds like common sense. But it's just, the point I'm trying to make is that it rewards consistency. That if you have a rider that can do super, super well at one particular track for whatever reason, whether it's his home track or it's his home country or the tires are really good at that track or the team has done a lot of testing in that track, whatever reason it is, that he can win that track and then the rest of the race he's only on a fifth or sixth, that's not going to be as good as the guy who can get up there in second and third all the time. And I think that's the way a race series should be done, and I think that's the elegance of the MotoGP system. So, like I said, the point system is almost, it definitely rewards consistency, and that's largely how Hayden won his championship last year. To give the guy credit, he came back from 8 points behind going into that last race last year at Valencia, and that hasn't been done since I don't know when. So, I'm not saying that Hayden didn't earn the championship. I'm just saying that he won it through consistency rather than an absolute stellar performance week in and week out and that sort of thing. He won it through consistency. So I hope this little diversion that we took into the point scoring system and everything made a certain amount of sense to me. When I read the emails, I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, I love the comparison and everything, and I wanted to share it with you guys, and we'll just sort of leave it at that. Hey Liam, how you doing?
Hey, great to hear your voice, Bob. Welcome back to the United States.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back, and,
ready to start doing MotoGP OD again. I've been home for about a month and haven't done anything.
I hardly think that you did nothing for the last month. I know how difficult it can be to change locations completely and how difficult it can be to acclimatize. So good luck with that. I mean, it must be hard just living with a family again after being surrounded by a bunch of guys.
Yeah, it's different, that's for sure. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of changes going on. But, in any case, I'm back, so, you know, kind of enough about that. Let's talk about you. So how are things going on Pramac Dantine and everything with the Liam's Wild Ride?
Well, Liam's Wild Ride is doing good. I just crossed the two-year mark when I first caught the bug big time to get into GP, and it culminated with a return trip to Shanghai last week, where I managed to stay for a few days after the race and revisit some of the places I'd been to in 2005, some of the restaurants, and just soak up more of that strange culture, because as much as the GP race impressed me when I was there in 2005, just being in such a different place and seeing that there's so much more to the world than I was experiencing in California really was part of the impetus that got me to move to Europe and say, heck with it, I'm gonna go for it or die trying. So Shanghai was fantastic.
That's cool. That's great. So you kind of have a sort of a special spot in your heart for Shanghai. And I mean, if they end up taking that race off the calendar, you're going to miss that one, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. It's the type of place where as much as it is a communist country and you know that the people are bound by so many rules, as a foreigner, I've never felt such a freedom in a country. I go there and I think, in part due to the exchange rate, that for just a really small amount of money, for a week I can have an amazing time and I can go to any restaurant I want in the city and I can do whatever I want to do. And you can ride in a taxi for just a few dollars for an hour. Just a bizarre imbalance compared to the rest of the countries in the world. So it really affords people an opportunity to go there and have a great time, you know, by U.S. or Western standards and not really feel burdened down by normal responsibility. If you want to go to a restaurant, if you want to go shopping, if you want to party all night, you're free to do whatever you want. And hotel rooms are amazing and they're cheap, and I encourage everybody to check it out, because the whole country is undergoing such tremendous change. It's really nice to be able to see it in this transitionary period before it becomes too much like Japan.
That's an interesting thought. So did you get a chance to do, like, on the days that you're staying off, did you kind of do the classic sort of touristy things and you know, go see some of the cultural sites and whatnot, or what were you mostly doing?
Absolutely. I spent a long time just watching people and walking around and stopping at any street vendor I wanted to during the day. And I think I spent almost no money during the day, but at night I made sure that we all went to great restaurants and really tried to get a complete balance between walking around in the poorest areas in the day and then going to the really chic and ultra high-end and trendy places at night. It's a really, really strange feeling to be in a place where they're serving you bottles of alcohol and cigars, and then the next day you're in a place where they've never seen anything like that, you know, and they're watching you eat because you're so strange to them. And it really makes you conscious of all the benefits and the gifts that we have with our lifestyle. You could see a luxury hotel, 4 or 5 star hotel, and then right next to it is a miniature shanty town where people don't have running water and they're hanging dirty clothes everywhere, and it's just such an imbalance that it's a really special place, and it's going to change. I mean, the bottom line is that as that country keeps getting stronger and starts producing more of their own goods, we'll see that change, and the people will eventually rise up to a level that's comparable or better than everyone else on the planet. It's just they're so big right now that they're undergoing growing pains, and it's going to take them a while.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really accurate statement there. And I know that, like, the Chinese economy is just cooking along and they need oil. That's going to shape our future to a large extent. Interesting. Did you see anything, like, I've read that sometimes in China you'll see particularly in like Hong Kong, this isn't stuff. You know, you'll see Ferrari driving down the road, and that some guy where he's, you know, he's doing the capitalist thing somehow or another in China and just having some super success, you know, and then on right on the other hand, the other side of the coin, like you said, you've got people that are living in dandy towns. Do you see stuff like that much?
Yes, absolutely. It's phenomenal to me that you can have all these little fake stores, a huge industry for that country, of all the fake stores and replica clothing and think that you can buy for pennies on the dollar. And right next door will be a high-end watch shop that is carrying every single major luxury watch on the planet. You know, they've got boatloads of Rolexes and Breitlings and Omegas, everything coming out of their ears at these luxury stores. You know, more than I could remember as far as the names of the brands. And then right next door, you could bargain and haggle and buy a nice jacket for $2. I mean, it's... And people are buying this stuff. The people that have money really have money, and the people that don't really don't. And there's no middle class. There doesn't seem to be an in-between. And automatically, from whatever social status you come from outside of China, as soon as you enter China, I think in part due to our education and our viewpoints, we're automatically a step up.
Oh, so that's... That's interesting, and it's cool that you managed to stay a few days extra after their, you know, after the race and everything to get some stuff going on with that and sort of experience that. I do remember that.
I have to thank my team for kind of giving me a few days break there.
Oh, the rest of them went back and they were going to work, weren't they? And yeah, you took a few days off, didn't you? So.
Well, I don't know if all of them went to work, but they definitely wanted to get out of China. The Europeans and as a whole generally didn't like any of the food or the culture. It's so alien to them that they can't handle it. It was as if they couldn't accept that this was a reality in China, and they just wanted to get back to their food and their families and their homes. And so many teams from the paddock left on Sunday night. It's a little strange to see everyone running away.
Yeah. Did you have the same problems this year that we read about with customs and just all of this of getting the gear there before the race and everything? Were there any major nightmares on that?
No, not at all.
No?
Actually, everything went really smoothly to China. Everything was there. One thing we couldn't buy distilled water. So we had to source other things. Yeah, overall, everything was really cool. And even from a technical viewpoint, when Ducati got protested, I guess, for the third time. They had to do an engine tear down after the race with Casey Stoner's bike to verify the displacement. It was that in itself was weird. I don't care what track you're at, just to see a GP engine being opened up right in the middle of a garage so that technical inspector can measure bore and stroke, that was just really strange.
Yeah,
and beautiful.
Yes, and I'm suddenly interested, and I want to hear more about this. So, when they do that, for instance, so the other team lodges a protest, and the technical inspector comes over. Now, the other team is not allowed anywhere near that, right? They don't actually see this happening, right?
Yeah, with the doors closed kind of deal. But our teams work side by side at every race, and I'm constantly back and forth between the garages. So I got a chance to look at things. I mean, I've seen the engine in pieces before at the factory, but what made it strange was not really seeing an engine open. I've built a lot of engines before. I know that they're all basically the same, but to actually be protested was a little bit of a shock. More unexpected. You didn't think that people were seriously considering that Ducati was trying to cheat. And it really signaled to me that the other manufacturers are grasping for straws a little bit. You know, no one when the Honda RC 211 came out in 02 and 03, and it just blew the fairings off of the two strokes and every other four stroke bike out there. No one said, "Oh, we can't believe this is real," because everyone has such faith in the engineering of HRC. I mean, it's fundamental. It's their core principle is that they're an engineering company. And to have an engineering company or Yamaha, I'm not really sure, because I honestly don't know the history on how many engines have actually been opened up or protested, but this is the first time I've heard of it. And usually I keep my ear close to the ground, so I know about these kind of things. It just was kind of bizarre. I don't know. Now that it's been proven, I know that people are working feverishly in Asia.
Yeah, I'll bet. And I mean, it's also like I was going to say the exact same point that you made, that the other teams are, you know, you said they're grasping at straws, and that I was going to say, you know, that this is proof that they're worried a bit. Apparently they're somewhat, you know, they know that they've got an issue going on. Moving on from that, you got Le Mans coming up. What do you kind of think in a technical sense with the, you know, you've got a more flowing nature there to the track at Le Mans. What do you guys think you're going to see? What are your feelings on that?
I wouldn't really call it a flowing nature because it's such a track to slam on the brakes, crank over, and then get on the gas. But it's to me, it's almost like a stop-and-go track. I think the bikes with a really nimble handling are going to do really well because they got to transition side to side. And I think that's going to play an advantage to the Yamaha, definitely, and perhaps even the Kawasaki. And I think traction control is going to be really important. Monitoring and measuring spin coming out of every corner with the right amount to let your tires last the length of the race. And speaking of tires, I've been thinking a little bit, and I was having some talks with some other people in the paddock, and this is Michelin foam track. And they obviously made a mistake in Turkey. They rectified in China. You know, I don't think they're going to make the same kind of error, but at a future race where they spring maybe the wrong material or they misjudge, you know, something when they create all the tires. It's a Michelin foam track, and I think they're going to come out swinging. And I think it's also worth pointing out because no one's really discussed it too much yet. In the beginning of the season, the preseason, Michelin said, okay, we know the bikes are going to go through the corners faster. We want to give people a more pointed front end. We're going to give you a 16-inch front tire with a different profile designed to maximize edge grip. And that's pretty radical when you switch all the tires, you know, from one size to another.
Sure.
We've only seen it a couple times. I mean, when they went from 18s to 16s and then 16.5, that was in the 80s. And now we're seeing a 16-inch front from Michelin. And that, to me, that's risky because we're switching to 800s, and that was an unknown, you know, kind of an unknown scenario. So Michelin maybe took two gambles. Not only were we switching to 800s, but then they said, well, we're confident we can handle the 800s, and we're going to make a 16-inch front tire for everybody.
So they've got
it might just be that, yeah, it might just be that there wasn't enough data, or everyone's initial impressions were really good. But I think it's definitely working for the Yamaha. But I wonder if it in part is contributing to the lack of feel on the Hondas. You know, because everything is a marriage. Everything needs to work as a package.
Right, and they've got everybody on the 16s. Then did they mandate that? They pretty much came in and said you're going to use 16s.
I don't know. That's just idle talk. I don't honestly know too many of the details, but just from a spectator point of view, I would think, wow, that's pretty ballsy to go to a 16 for everybody, especially when we're switching to a new bike with different handling characteristics. Then again, it could have been a smarter decision just to say, okay, it's brand new bike, new challenges. Let's just go with this, and we'll work the 16 through the evolution of the 800. And as our tire gets better and the bikes get better, it's only going to pay off in the end. I mean, Michelin is a company that has years of experience dominating the sport, so they know what they're doing.
Right.
And again, the Japanese manufacturers really, really know what they're doing too. So we'll just have to see how it plays out. I mean, everyone has been talking about a Ducati domination, and it's the bike, and it's the bike, but we're only, you know, 20% of the way into the season.
Right, exactly. There's a lot of season left to go.
Yeah.
On the tires, do you think that the new tire regulations are, how much do you think that is the root of some of the problems that we're seeing from Michelin? Do you think they've been relying on that ability to make tires and have them shipped in, or just, you know, have the vast numbers of tires and that's what affecting them, or what do you think?
Of course. I think that definitely comes into play. Bridgestone has always had their routine because they have to ship out of Japan, so they've always had to plan in advance. and they've never been able to make a magical mystery tire overnight based on the data from Friday and Saturday. And whether, I don't think Michelin overlooked that. They knew that this year they would have to plan in advance, and I'm sure they did their homework, but it's still hard to switch. And I think Turkey might have been an example of that. I wonder also about Colin Edwards. It's definitely important that the new rules and the limits for rear tires, it's definitely coming into play. Manufacturers bring a lot less as far as material for the track, because we choose on Thursday. They've got their options. But really, you can't swap through three or four tires in a session the way we could before. You can't say, well, you know what, I really want to try that one again because that I'm not sure if this one felt better than that one. Or you know, you're limited. But, you know, if you've got the amount of tires and you think, okay, I need two qualifiers, then that leaves you with 15 tires, or, I mean, 12 tires, and you've got three sessions plus some morning warm-up where you want to have, you know, potentially your race tire to warm up with, and then you want a fresh race tire. Then you've got to think, well, I needed to test the race tire either on Friday or Saturday in the afternoon during, you know, hopefully race time conditions. It's really, really narrowed down the options as far as tires. And it goes two ways. One, it means that the tire companies and the chief mechanics and the riders, when they get together on Thursday, they really need to have a clear idea of what they think is going to happen and what they're going to use. And then two, it really plays to rider feel. If a rider can really analyze it and you say, okay, you've only got five things to choose from and we can't go back and forth and jump around, then they have to really nail their analysis of the tire and how they feel and whether or not they think it's going to last the race. And for that reason, it plays to the rider's strength also.
Okay, and then on this tire rule, some of the details of it for listeners that haven't been completely following, and even for me, beyond this, there's just a flat limit on you will bring this many, or you can have this many fronts and you can have this many rears, which the numbers escape me off the top of my head. And then other than that, you have to have your basically your sort of those tires have to be specified by Thursday, and that's it? That's what you're working with?
Yeah, that's it. That's for slicks. And for cut slicks, like intermediates and rain tires, there's an unlimited supply. But we haven't had a wet, you know, a full-on rainy weekend, so we haven't really been able to exploit that. That might throw a wrench into things, too. But, yeah, all the tires are chosen with 17 fronts and 14 rears. Reverse, sorry about that. And you choose what range you're going to use on Thursday, and then that's it. All the codes listed for each tire are then logged. They go to technical director, and then we have a person planted in each garage that will physically scan the barcodes when the tires go on and off the bike during the session. So it's perfectly monitored, and everybody knows, oh, okay, you changed two tires or three tires or however many tires in a session. In a way, it's easier, and in a way, it's not. I mean, you have to be on your game on Thursday. You can't expect to go out and run around on Friday and then narrow it down on Saturday. It takes a little bit more focus now.
And now, those numbers of tires, when you got 17 rears, so how does that compare to previous years of what you might go through? Are you finding you're having to, are you guys using scuffs, for instance, where, you know, you go out and do a few laps on one tire and you're saving it to put back on the bike later, or what else, what numbers are you looking at?
I can't talk about that.
Okay, that's fine. I suppose I should not have asked that question, huh?
No, it's not that you can't ask, but game has raised another level this year, and every little thing counts. The only thing that we know about every other team and every tire manufacturer is that you have 14 fronts and 17 rears. That's it. However you choose to use them, if you want to use 10 on Friday and 2 on Saturday, or, you know, just order all the same tire, that's a lot of the equation, though.
Is there a provision for a bad tire? I mean, do you get an extra tire if it turns out that one that you got had a defect of some kind?
No.
Oh, wow. No
return. Well, that's on the manufacturer. It's on the manufacturer. They know they've got to provide this many tires, and if they don't do their job, then you know, that's on them.
Right, right. But, you know, I mean, bad tires do turn up, you know, very rarely, but, you know, so I was wondering if you might get a bonus tire.
No, I don't. I'm not aware of the provisions of the rules for that.
Yeah. Hopefully you guys don't have to find out either and find out the hard way or something and with it. And it's generally not a good thing. So we had Alex Barros finished fourth there in Turkey. And, mm-hmm. I mean, that's awesome. Things are looking really, really good for the team. You guys are looking really strong out there when we see you. And a good thing. So what are you thinking when you go to Mugello? Is that going to be sort of like, do you feel somewhat that that's like your team's home race, or since your team is based in Spain, are you more looking forward to Catalunya or what for those next few races that are coming up?
It's sort of equal for me. Mugello was my first GP race that I won, and I think it's such a special track and in such a special area. There's a magical aura that kind of surrounds that race for me, and it's the home of Ducati, and it's the home of our main sponsor. So and a lot of the technical people on our team are Italian. My friends on the team are Italian. So that's really their home race. And then the other half of the team is Spanish. The structure and the administration, the background is Spanish. So we immediately go to Catalunya, and it's the same kind of pie, the same, you know, feeling in the garage where the boys are like, yes, we're home, this is it. So it's 2 weeks of home races. But we're really getting into the meat of the season. And we've got 7 races coming up in 10 weeks, so that's going to be a little tricky.
Yeah, you're going to be
downtime.
Oh, sorry, what?
Right, there is no downtime. There is no downtime. We're doing laundry in the hotel, so you're trying to juggle. Oh, okay, I need to wash my uniforms, but then there's your personal clothes too. I mean, you got to wash your underwear and socks at some point. you know, there are little complications that any one little thing goes wrong and all of a sudden somebody's, you know, out. Or if they lose your luggage, like, I don't know, a couple of guys on the team have lost their luggage already this year. They got it back, but 2 or 3 days is too late.
Oh, yeah, it's, yeah, terrible. Yeah.
So there's a lot of little details that come into play that most people don't see, or even injuries. You know, I had 2 mechanics go down with injuries in Turkey. One broke his ankle. And the other one suffered a broken arm a few days before. So there's a lot of things that happened in the background. And I don't know, it's nice.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I can understand where, you know, something like, you know, 7 races in 10 weeks it might be great for the fans because, you know, while all of a sudden throwing a lot of work onto you guys, and I'll bet you guys are tired after that and pretty much ready for that that midsummer break too.
Completely. I've written about it before, but sometimes at a race, I don't know if it's the focus or the energy that we put into it, but the travel wears you out too. So usually when I get back from a race, it takes me a day to kind of get back up on my feet. Well, you know, I'll check email during the day, but I'm not replying to anything that's not critical. I'm not looking at photos or doing anything. I'm just trying to rest and make sure that I'm going to be healthy for the next weekend. And particularly with these back-to-back races, it might be possible that we go back home for one day, and it's the kind of day where it's like you go home, and I would be expecting to sleep and rest, but we're going to flip and do our laundry and then get out the next day. So it's a tricky time. And also, you know, we're still dealing with the same problems of making sure that all the pieces come and everything's logged in, checked in, pieces are sent out back and forth. There's going to be a lot of good things in the mail going back and forth between us and the factory and our race shop. And the boys that are mechanics that drive the semi-trucks are going to be gone for 2.5 months from their home because they're not going to get a chance to go home. The guys that drive the semi-trucks, we pair them up 2 and 2 per truck. So that's 4 mechanics. That will go to the race with their bag and their truck. They'll drive through the race, do the race. We pack the truck up on Sunday night or on Monday if we have a test. And then they drive immediately to the next track, and their responsibility is to guard the truck. So they're not leaving the truck somewhere and flying home or even driving home. They just go from racetrack to racetrack. And those guys are hardcore.
Yeah, it's
you know,
taking
when you
it.
Think about yeah, take the toll living in a truck, because they're not in a hotel either, necessarily. It's it takes a lot of fortitude to be able to focus and work as hard as they do at the racetrack and then drive those distances. And this is the really crappy thing about Europe. They've got speed regulations on semi-trucks, so you can't go past, you know, X kilometers an hour, which is like 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. This is horrible. I can't think that, oh man, if I was stuck in a semi, to be just trundling along at 60 miles an hour would drive me insane.
Not only are you driving everywhere, you're driving there slow too, yeah.
Yeah, that would drive me insane. You can't think, oh, well, I'm going to make up some time here. This is a good, you know, couple hours of flat stretch. No, you got to just trundle along. But I am excited. I am excited for Le Mans. And, you know, we'll just have to concentrate on getting the best setup we can and see if we can surprise some people, and we're going to try and do that at every race. And while Mugello has traditionally been an Italian race, we'll see if we can't throw something into the mix.
Cool, cool. All right, well, Liam, we're gonna be talking to you again several times throughout the season. I would like to say, you know, thanks again for all the, you know, the emails and whatnot that you sent me while I was in Iraq, and it made me feel, you know, hey, I got people at home. And we wish you the best of luck over there, and I hope you have a great race here at Le Mans, Mugello, and Catalunya coming up. And like I said, I'm sure we'll be talking to you before too long again, so we'll save some of our some of the cool stories and whatnot for those later calls. And why don't we say goodbye on this one?
All right. Thanks, Bob. It's really been great catching up with you, and I look forward to speaking with you in MotoGPOD later this year. You know the number, so... Already, that's a good sign.
Okay.
And enjoy the races, Bob. Enjoy
I will. The races. Thanks very much, Liam. Bye-bye.
All right.
All right. Thanks again to Liam. I always like having you on the show, and your insight and knowledge of the paddock is just spectacular, and we really enjoy having you. So it's always nice to hear from you. And listeners out there, if you want to check out Liam's website, it's at motoliam.com, motoliam.com. And it's a beautiful website. Very well done. Liam's got a blog going. He puts up lots of pictures and you know, kind of the usual blog sort of internet diary thing about all of his various adventures in the paddock and links to all kinds of other important stuff. And it's a great website. You should really check it out, motoliam.com. We've got lots of ideas and topics that I want to cover in future editions of MotoGPOD. So we're going to be doing some more and more shows. Like I said, we're going back to the weekly schedule here. We'll be putting out the shows. Going to be kind of hoping to keep the length around 45 minutes or so, which is about where we're at today. So trying to avoid some of these gigantic shows, but sometimes you just get talking about stuff and it's just too good to quit. And the show is interesting, so I haven't heard too many complaints. And again, if listeners out there, if you have any feedback that you'd like to send to us on that, just go ahead and send it. MotoGPOD at MotoGPOD.com is the address, and then Jules, Bob, and Jim Race will all get that email there. And tell your friends about MotoGPOD too. We, like I said, we're back, so we want to get the word out again that MotoGPOD is on a regular schedule. I don't like to go to, you know, internet forums where I'm not a regular member or something and just start posting random spam about listening to my podcast and all that kind of business. So I ask you, the listeners, to do that for me. So if you like the show and you want to tell your friends about it, you know, please feel free. They can check us out at MotoGPOD.com, and they can subscribe to us in iTunes and all that good stuff. And as always, send in your suggestions. Again, the email address, MotoGPOD at MotoGPOD.com. We'd like to hear suggestions about what you would like to hear on the show. And we always do try to get interviews. That's pretty much the number one suggestion of, you know, we want more interviews. We've managed to get some really good ones. Jules just went above and beyond. He got Colin Edwards on the show and Alex Hoffman and just all kinds of great talent of people that are on the show that I wasn't able to get. So thanks, Jules, for that. And we're going to get those guys back again on the show. We'll be talking to Chuck Axlin from Team KR here shortly, I'm sure. So we've got a lot of good stuff coming up. And that's going to do it for today. We are actually recording this show. I got to admit, I'm recording the show way ahead of time. This is Monday night, Monday the 14th of May, and I'm recording the show. So if some interesting news comes up in the MotoGP world between now and Friday, unfortunately, you're not going to hear about it on MotoGPOD until the next show, the one that we're going to do following Le Mans. I have a busy schedule this week. I'm doing a track day on Thursday, which is in the past by the time you're listening to this show, and hopefully I'm not going to come on next week's show and tell you that I wiped my bike out or anything like that. I'm pretty sure that won't happen, but you never know. And so it's been a little bit weird that I'm doing this so far ahead of time. Normally, I should record the shows on Thursday night for a Friday posting, but we're doing this one a little bit ahead of time, and thanks again to Liam for helping make that possible, and I hope you enjoyed the show, and we are out. Oh, geez, got the tape in there backwards here. One more time.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.